This is Sciographies, an introduction to people who make Canadian science happen.
I'm David Barkley, co-host and an assistant professor in the Department of Oceanography.
I'm Shauna Bullman, co-host, neuroscience student, and science communication intern.
I'm Nicole Comeau, and we're all from Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science. In this episode, we speak with Dr. Sean Barrett, a professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience and head of the Dalhousie Substance Use and Addictions Lab. There, he studies substances like tobacco and alcohol to better understand how different factors contribute to addictive behaviors. Now, you may have heard, but Canada recently became the second nation in the world to legalize cannabis. Legalization will come into effect in October 2018, making the substance more easily available to study. Sean and other Canadian researchers are especially interested in developing methods to study cannabis, an area of research that's currently lacking due to its illegal status. What we know about how weed affects the brain and body is actually quite limited if you were to compare it to what we know scientifically about how tobacco and alcohol affects us. Sean is here to tell us a little bit about himself, his research, and how the legalization of cannabis creates an opportunity to build a new scientific understanding of its use.
I know more about your research than I do about you.
Okay.
So I know you went to St. FX.
I did indeed.
For your undergrad, and then you went, then you were on to McGill. But so where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Belleville, Ontario. And it's, for those that don't know, it's a small city between Toronto and Montreal, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably around 50,000 people.
Yeah, my only Belleville experience is like literally stopping there to go to like the Taco Bell.
Yeah, that's how people know Belleville. Yeah. It's a pit stop on the drive between Toronto and Montreal.
Yeah.
It was a fairly good place to grow up. I went to a couple of different high schools there. It actually took me an extra year to finish high school. So when I was 13, my family separated, so my parents got a divorce, and I sort of bounced around between my mom's house and my dad's house, and my academic performance suffered a little bit during those years. My grades weren't strong enough to get into university.
Right.
And that was a real eye-opener for me. I had some of my friends go off to start their post-secondary education, and I was left at home in Belleville. And from that moment forward, I never had a grade lower than an A. It was a real eye-opener and a real kick in the pants for me.
So was the small town living part of the wake-up call? Were you like, all your friends went off to university and you were...
Well, it was just a matter of, you know, you have your cohort of friends mm-hmm. moving on with their lives. There was also a sense of, I really need to start thinking seriously about what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life.
Sure.
And at that point, you know, my last year of high school, what should have been my last year of high school, I was getting like, you know, 55 average, right. 60 average type of thing. And I knew that my options would be limited, but I also wanted to be in a position where I could use my intellectual capabilities to some extent professionally as well.
Yeah.
And it was really just finding the motivation and having a goal in mind that really helped me turn things around. You know, a lot of the times through high school, it was almost like I was kind of drifting. I would show up to class, but I wouldn't really be engaged. And I was just going through the motions. And it really wasn't until I had something concrete that I wanted to achieve, i.e. Get into a university, then I found my motivation to be serious about my studies.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Because obviously your family played had a pretty big role in this dynamic, but at the same time, you had a bit of self-realization there at a pretty young age. So were they role models in terms of what to do or what not to do?
Well, my father has a fairly interesting background. So he was a champion weightlifter. So he represented Canada at Commonwealth Games, Pan American Games, Canadian Championships. And so he's actually still involved with the Canadian Weightlifting Association. He's president. He was trained as an accountant.
Okay.
So he was the
very practical.
Very practical. Very practical. So he worked for Revenue Canada, and he was the first individual from his family to get a university degree. My mother was a teacher at a community college, and so she always valued education as well. The extra year that I spent in high school, my mother spent a lot of time with me, helped me work on my writing skills and these types of things, just to make sure that I had the academic skills that I needed in order to really succeed.
I see. Yes, and she was, so your father was kind of quantitative side, and she was teaching the arts and letters at community college?
Well, more or less. So she was teaching in a she taught psychology, actually.
Okay.
In a law and security program, individuals that are going through to become border guards or prison guards or police officers. So she did the psychology and sociology instruction.
Maybe a challenging group of students for her?
No, I suspect, but I think she really appreciated the opportunity to try mm-hmm. to humanize the individuals that the future correctional officers and police officers would have to encounter mm-hmm. in their careers.
Yeah.
So I think that was a really a big motivator for my mother to try to not only impart knowledge to her students, but also to try to humanize the experiences of individuals who are less fortunate,
right?
And this type of thing.
Were both of their were your father and your mother's family also from Belleville? Like, was it like, were you clans?
Well, actually, my grandfather was from Halifax.
Okay.
My great grandfather was from Halifax. He survived the Halifax explosion.
Wow.
And my grandfather, after the Second World War, did his medical degree at Dalhousie, class of 52. And so he was a physician.
Okay, you mentioned your great-grandfather living in Halifax, surviving the explosion.
Right.
Is there like family lore about that? Have you heard the story?
Everyone was at home when the explosion happened. All the windows in the house were completely blown out. My great-grandfather lost his hearing. My great-uncle was a baby, and he wasn't harmed. But it was a fairly traumatic event for my great-grandparents, as far as I understand. My great-grandfather was actually a stonemason, and you know that tower at Dingle Park?
Yeah.
He's the man that actually put in all of the stairs.
Wow.
however many years ago that was. And there was a statue that was here at Dalhousie up until about 3 or 4 years ago, and it had to be taken down. Reg Dockrell, my great uncle, was a sculptor. Mm-hmm. Taking after his father, I suppose, and he was commissioned to do some artwork for Dalhousie. And that was one of the first things I noticed when I became a professor. My mother said, "Oh, you're going to have to find your Uncle Walter statue." And so I'm like, all right. And sure enough, it was there. And
wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong, but Trotsky walked on stairs that your great-grandfather built. Is that right?
Indeed, yeah.
There you go. So psychology was from the get-go because of your family history?
No. So initially, I took courses essentially across the arts. In my second year, I decided to focus on philosophy and sociology. In my third year, my focus became more sociology. Mm-hmm. And I took a research methods course in sociology and had my first research experience in sociology, and I found it to be terrific. Mm-hmm. But then I ended up switching into psychology the following year because I had an idea for research that wasn't appropriate through the lens of sociology, and it was something that I really wanted to explore. So I needed to get training in psychology, and I decided to pursue an honors degree in psychology.
So that's, for a third year student, that's pretty strategic.
Well, it meant an extra year.
Yeah.
It took me 5 instead of 4 years to finish. What happened was I was reading a magazine, I think it was a Time magazine or something along those lines, and it was talking about this recent discovery that a neurochemical called dopamine was involved with lots of different types of rewarding behavior. So things like natural rewards, like sexual behavior, feeding, dopamine would be released in response to the use of a variety of drugs like alcohol, cocaine, and nicotine. And this article mentioned that they actually discovered that there were nicotine receptors located on the dopamine neurons. And it got me to thinking, well, gee, it's there was a stereotype that people like to have a cigarette after sex. I was a smoker myself at the time, and I knew that I always wanted to have a cigarette after I ate a big meal. And I also noticed that a lot of other behaviors that release dopamine seemed to be associated with a higher prevalence of smoking. So people that drank alcohol or people that used drugs. Dopamine, I knew from one of my electives, was also released in response to stress. I knew that people wanted to smoke when they were stressed. And I had an uncle who had schizophrenia growing up, and he was a 3 or 4 pack a day smoker. And of course, dopamine's involved in schizophrenia.
Right.
So I had this idea, well, maybe things that increase dopamine levels in the brain make people smoke more. And as it turns out, no one had looked into that before, and no one had looked at the association between these different types of behaviors and people's propensity to smoke. So I was really motivated to see if I could find an answer, and it really excited me. And it was almost like a light switch went off in my brain, and I became very sort of passionately, it became like a real motivator for me to try to find an answer to this question.
And this project became kind of the foundational project of your career, right? I mean, this is the question you based most of your career on, or the beginning at least?
I think so. I think that virtually everything I've done, so I've published probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 papers, I'd say 68 of them have been somehow related to this original honors project idea I had back in 1996.
That's really incredible. So you do this, obviously blockbuster project, and then choosing to go to grad school was a no-brainer at that point.
Right. I just wanted to continue to...
And people were recruiting you, or were you...
Well, no. I had very little science background, mm-hmm. and I was applying to science programs.
Yeah.
And in fact, I applied to probably a half dozen or so graduate programs in psychology and neuroscience, including Dalhousie. Mm-hmm. And I was only admitted into one, and it happened to be McGill.
Okay. So you got to Montreal and you were playing catch up a little bit again.
Yeah, I was playing catch up. I did a lot of self-directed reading. Mm-hmm. So while I was at McGill, I had two different research streams. So the second research stream was also based on my honors work. So for my honors work, I was interested to see how people using other drugs affected their smoking behavior. So that got me interested in real-life drug-taking patterns.
Sure.
And one of the things that was really popular was this rave culture. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up doing some work looking at polysubstance use. A lot of times when a person's a drug user, they'll use more than one substance at a time during the same session. And so that provides an opportunity for the drugs to interact and to influence what's happening in the brain as well as influence behavior. And as it turns out, for many drugs, using other substances during the same session is the rule rather than the exception. So when people attend a rave, everyone talks about ecstasy, but it's usually not just ecstasy. So usually people are using ecstasy and maybe tobacco and maybe alcohol and maybe amphetamine, but no one had detailed any of that at that point. I convinced my supervisor, Dr. Bob Peel, to buy myself and a couple of my friends rave tickets to go to these rave events to see if we could figure out what patterns of substance use people are engaged in.
Yeah.
And that turned into an entire separate stream of of work as well.
And did you have an interest in the music, the culture itself?
No, it was actually, I was like a fish out of water.
You went not alone, you're with colleagues.
I went with, there was another graduate student who worked in my lab, John Shostowski. I put on a tight shirt. And,
so you did, I was going to ask, you went into costume. You weren't wearing a button-up shirt and a tie.
Well, yeah, kind of had a pocket protector and like, you know.
Or something.
Well, you know, I still had like my clipboard and, you know. We set up a little areas at these rave events where we'd give people water, condoms, candies, this type of thing. And we'd use that as a means of letting them know about the study that we're going to be conducting, and recruiting participants. What we ended up doing is doing a recruitment at the raves, but actually conducting the research at McGill. So we'd bring people into the lab, and then I developed a method for assessing polysubstance use in an interview where we get people to focus on a single event. So tell me about the last rave you're at. Who were you with? What were you doing? Give me all the details you can. Now walk me through the sequence of drugs that you used. And as it turns out, there were reliable patterns of drug mixing. For example, almost always people started with alcohol. And then often they'd take some sort of psychostimulant, and then they'd end their evening using some marijuana. And as it turns out, if you take alcohol before you take a psychostimulant, what happens is that the alcohol is being metabolized in your liver by the same enzymes that metabolize the psychostimulant drugs, which means that the psychostimulant drugs can't be metabolized at this regular rate, increases the level of the psychostimulant in your blood, meaning you get a greater psychostimulant effect, right? So there are practical consequences and ramifications for the patterns of use.
So, okay, so you didn't get sucked into the culture. You saw
a
little bit of it.
No,
you're living a pretty conventional...
I think so. It's very difficult to study a phenomenon as being an insider.
All right, David was able to get Sean's personal story covered, and it is quite fascinating. But let's go to Shauna now so she can dig a little deeper into the science.
So at Dalhousie, you are the lead of the Substance Use and Addiction Lab. And from our previous conversation, it looks like your studies span various types of research methods, but they all tie back to your original research question. So can you tell me a little bit about the research that you're doing at Dal right now or in recent years?
Sure. So one of the things that I've been principally engaged with at Dalhousie is work involving tobacco use and a couple of different areas. So we examine how different pharmacological and non-pharmacological factors influence smoking behavior, cigarette craving, how rewarding cigarette smoking is, et cetera. If you give someone alcohol, how does that impact their smoking behavior? And we also look at the opposite. So if you give someone tobacco, how does that impact their drinking behavior?
So you've talked lots about smoking, but there's a new type of smoking on the radar with legalization of cannabis coming up. And so right now, what does the scientific literature look like for cannabis? Do we know what there is to know, or there's a lot lacking.
Well, there's a lot lacking currently. So the legal status of the drug has complicated efforts to examine it scientifically to the same degree as other substances that are legally available, such as alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine would be three good examples. A few years ago, when here at Dalhousie, I wanted to do some interviews with cannabis users about their patterns of cannabis use, as well as their reasons for using the drug. And the Research Ethics Board had some legitimate concerns that one, by volunteering to participate in my research, individuals would be outing themselves as doing an illegal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And so we eventually resolved the issue by recruiting individuals. We had an ad saying, have you ever used cannabis? Or if you've never used cannabis, you know, you can volunteer for this research study. As it turns out, 95% of the people that responded to the ad were cannabis users. One area where there are some pretty significant gaps, in, at least in my opinion, relate to the various purported medicinal properties of cannabis, and in particular CBD or cannabidiol. A lot of very diffuse forms of illness are purportedly effectively treated with cannabis, so everything from, you know, glaucoma to epilepsy to anxiety to depression to nausea. And the list seems to be growing exponentially as time goes on. But there's not really a solid foundation for scientific foundation for cannabis actually being efficacious for relieving many of these ailments. So there's very limited scientific data to suggest that cannabis has any effectiveness for things like pain or, you know, chemotherapy-related nausea, even though that's what patients will tell you. So really, the best practices and scientific methods have not been applied to cannabis use as a potential medicine, at least for many of the conditions for which, at least anecdotally, has been prescribed.
So there's been a lot of stories about it being a bit of a end-all be-all miracle drug, but there's not a lot of foundation behind that yet.
There's not a lot of foundation behind it yet. That's right.
Could go either way.
Well, potentially. So one of the things that that we know about drug responses is a lot of times, they at least in part depend upon what the drug user expects to happen,
mm-hmm.
right? So if an individual thinks, well, cannabis is supposed to be good for anxiety, and if I smoke some cannabis or vaporize some cannabis, I'll feel less anxious. To what extent do they feel less anxious because they believe that the drug is going to work versus there being some inherent property of the drug itself that has a direct physiological impact on anxiety, for an example?
The old placebo effect. Yeah, just back to it.
Yeah, indeed.
So that plays a pretty big part in the majority of your research.
Well, just to try to understand the different factors that contribute to drug responses, particularly, the reinforcing properties of drugs. So that contribute to things like drug craving or the pleasurable effects of using a drug. To what extent are these things related to an individual psychoactive compound versus a combination of psychoactive compounds versus different psychological processes and factors, including things like expectations about what you did or what effects you think the drug will have. These are all things that have been empirically shown to impact other types of drug responses. So certainly in the cases of nicotine and tobacco and alcohol, for example, we know that expectancy effects can have a pretty profound influence on drug response. Less is known about how these factors impact various cannabis responses. And given that it's being so widely used for such a wide variety of conditions, I think it's important research that needs to be done.
In terms of what we know about cannabis right now, what have we answered research-wise?
Well, we've certainly answered a lot of important questions. So we have a pretty good idea about the mechanisms of action through which cannabis produces its psychoactive effects. Mm-hmm. We've identified various compounds, cannabinoids that contribute to various cannabis-related effects. So I think that's a really important thing. We know a little bit about how cannabis affects cognition and memory. There's some evidence of cannabis being associated with different psychiatric disorders, such as psychosis as an example of an area where we know that there's at least a correlation between using cannabis during a critical period and having an increased risk for developing psychosis. So there are some things that are fairly well established.
And so what does legalization mean specifically for your lab? Is it you're going to head that direction, or?
Well, it certainly makes things a little bit less complicated in terms of trying to do research that involves administering cannabis to the humans, right? So often when we think about cannabis effects, we think about applying sort of a one-size-fits-all
right.
approach. This is how cannabis affects individuals. But one of the things I'm potentially interested in exploring is seeing to what extent there are individual differences or biomarkers that might predict different types of responses to cannabis. So for some individuals, it might be, you know, the same strain might be more relaxing or more, sedating for one individual, and it might make another individual more hyperactive or talkative, as an example. So understanding to what extent those individual differences exist. Now, not only do you have individual differences in terms of the users, you also have individual differences in terms of the plants, right? So there are multiple strains of cannabis that are going to be, that are currently available on the black market, and almost certainly that will be available in the legal market. And to what extent do different cannabis strains lead to different effects in the same individual?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent are there differences in terms of the individual constituents of cannabis? So there are several cannabinoids that contribute to the psychoactive effects. So are all of them uniformly important for everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Or are some individuals, so for example, do you have a THC-sensitive individual, perhaps, or maybe a CBD-sensitive individual?
Right.
So it's really, I think, a good place to start would be just understanding the parameters from an individual difference approach, mm-hmm. rather than trying to lump everyone in together measuring sort of looking at subtypes of users.
Sure. Yeah. So you want to look at the variables instead of maybe the way that we talk about alcohol all the way to cannabis, in that we're not all sort of the same bag of bones.
That's
right.
We have
genetics, personality differences.
That's exactly right. So seeing if there are endophenotypes of cannabis users that may be more or less sensitive to different pharmacological constituents, as well as whether or not there are non-pharmacological factors that also contribute to how an individual experiences the drug.
All right, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Sean.